He stole into the drawing room, which was full of company, not to interrupt the song which a young girl was singing to the harp. It was the Irish cronan of Ned of the Hill. The air was scarce finished when he sprang forward and seized the harpist in his arms, exclaiming, "This must be Sidney Owenson. It is her father's voice. None but an Irish voice could have such a curve in it. And she is my godchild." And he had not seen his godchild since the christening dinner.
The idea of the emerald green, you know, Ireland being the Emerald Isle, a gem in the ocean. All of those ideas which were slightly set in float by the volunteers in the 1780s and then really taken on board by the United Irishmen in the 1790s, she almost wholesale transports that whole iconography and imagery into her fiction.
She saw the harp as a way of saying, you know, we're here, this is Ireland, this is a symbol of reverence and a symbol of our culture and sophistication, and a symbol of really what we have that you don't.
As a national symbol in Ireland, cannot be underestimated. Not only is it to be found in government correspondence, the euro coin, the presidential flag, but it is also possibly Ireland's most recognisable product icon. Think Ryanair and Guinness, to name just two. The harp has long been associated with cultural tradition in Ireland, a reminder of the rich musical heritage of the travelling bards. But it was also appropriated as a political symbol. One woman had a remarkable influence on the promotion of the modern Irish harp. Sidney Owenson, later known as Lady Morgan, was a writer and a celebrity cult figure of the early 19th century. Her best-known novel was called The Wild Irish Girl, and she styled herself on the heroine. In her heyday, Sidney Owenson's playing of the harp was considered wildly evocative and erotic. But she remained unperturbed by the seemingly bad press. In fact, she even seems to have encouraged it. Julie Donovan teaches on the Women's Leadership Programme at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. She has quite an interest in Sidney Owenson, describing her as an intriguing, yet mostly forgotten woman. Julie, Sidney Owenson is a mostly forgotten woman. Is that really the case?
The Wild Irish Girl in particular, her most famous novel, which was published in 1806, that is now being taught in universities in Ireland and in the United Kingdom and indeed in North America. Sidney Owenson is becoming more of an interest in academia, but if you walk into any high street bookstore or go on Amazon.com, you won't find very many books by her. So to that extent, she is a mostly forgotten writer. Bit like Mariah Edgeworth, actually, who was very famous in her own time. But if you stop most people in the street in Ireland today, I don't think they would recognise either Sidney Owenson or Mariah Edgeworth. Thomas More, yes, but not those two writers.
OK, so maybe you won't find her novels on the shelves of your local bookstore. But as Julie says, Sidney is making something of a comeback in academic circles, at least. Claire Connolly is another confirmed fan. She's Professor of Modern English at University College Cork and has written about Sidney Owenson and the writings of Edmund Burke, Mariah Edgeworth, Charles Robert Maturin and Thomas More. Claire, tell us about Sidney Owenson. Who was she? And retrospectively, why has she become so interesting today?
So Sidney Owenson was a young Irish woman born sometime in the 1770s. Her father was an actor, and she grew up in a kind of, probably a slightly kind of rackety household where there was lots of comings and goings, and her father was travelling, and sometimes she travelled with him, and so on. She did have some formal education, and she read a lot. That's one of the most important things about her. She read and read and read. And at an early age, she wanted to make her own living. She had to, because of the family circumstances. She tried being a governess for a while. She lived in Westmeath. And while she was there, she saw the kinds of books that her young charges were reading and thought she could probably write something like that herself. And so she published her first novel in 1803. And she went on from there to really build a very successful career as a professional woman writer who could live entirely by her own pen. And I suppose that aspect of her, Sidney Owenson, as a professional, as a kind of woman who sustained her own career and made her own reputation, has been one of the things that's drawn us back to her. It wasn't unusual for women to write at the period. In fact, arguably, especially in terms of the novel, she was really writing in a time of female dominance. She's writing a little bit before Jane Austen, but she's one of the writers that makes it easier for somebody like Jane Austen to come along and get her novels published. So it's actually quite a good time to be a woman novelist. But the problem was, it was very hard to make a living by your writing. And a number of the writers, I suppose most notably her contemporary Maria Edgeworth, would have had a much more kind of secure economic circumstances, you know, the support of the family, and was able to kind of write in relatively leisured circumstances. So it's that particular role of her as a professional and somebody who kind of really shaped her own career that makes her so interesting to us now.
So along came her novel, The Wild Irish Girl. What was so special about it?
What she did in that novel was overhaul the image of Ireland as backward and bog-ridden. And she takes a character called Horatio Mortimer, whose father is an absentee landlord in Ireland. And Horatio's been a naughty boy in London, and he's being sent to the worst place, sort of early 19th century Siberia, which was Ireland. He's been sent to Ireland as a punishment. So he's going over there, you know, dreading this very backward country. And Horatio talks about reading Fiennes Morrison and all the Elizabethan writers and sort of Elizabethan propaganda about Ireland being this very backward country. But yet when he comes to Ireland, he is converted by the culture and the sophisticated culture that he sees with the people. And the person who converts him and sort of educates the ignorant English colonizer is Glovina O'Melville, and she's a Gaelic princess whose father, the Prince of Inishmore, has been dispossessed. She educates him and he becomes besotted with her, and he learns about Ireland being this sophisticated country and not what it was portrayed in propaganda. So she overhauls the image of Ireland as being backward, and she uses a lot of textiles in this novel, and she's going back to the work of Jonathan Swift, who encouraged the Irish to wear their own textiles as a powerful method of self-determination. And she talks about the Irish textile industry, which was very strong, which England tried to quash. So there's a lot of clothes. Glovina wears Gaelic costume and plays the harp. And Owenson was very interested in antiquarian theory of the time, which tried to find different origins for the Irish, which proved their sort of sophisticated, you know, heritage. So she mixes a lot of these strands together, basically reappropriating images of the Irish and reinventing them.
points and spend a lot of time thinking about what kind of heroine she was going to have and what kind of knowledge and what kind of whole cultural world, really, that heroine would represent. So it doesn't really come from her own head to the extent that she based a lot of it on antiquarian sources, on her readings in Irish history, in Irish botany, folklore, legends and so on. But she does sort of pull it all together in her own unique way and to create this kind of hybrid Gaelic princess character, Glorvina, who became such a kind of an interesting model whom people wanted to dress up like and so on. She was playing the harp and she was singing bardic songs, and Owenson then takes the trouble to kind of render some of those bardic songs in the novel. So in the middle of the third person novel, you know, the kind of thing that would never happen in a Jane Austen novel, really, the narrative breaks off so that you can have the text of three or four bardic poems with footnotes explaining, you know, potential meanings of those of those songs and so on. So the whole text of the novel is very alive to the kind of sounds and feelings and textures of the Ireland of the time. It used to always be said of this novel, certainly when I was a graduate student and starting to think about writing about it myself, the dominant view was always that she made it all up. That's what we used to always be told. And I think there was a kind of a view that she was this kind of pretty young woman, and what on earth would she know about things anyway? And it all seems quite fanciful. But in fact, when you start to do the research, it's no more fanciful than what a lot of the antiquarians and historians were writing at the period. And in fact, I did a textual edition of the novel. So I spent a long time kind of tracing each of her sources and, as it were, kind of reconstructing what her library would have been. And I found that in many cases, she is extremely close to contemporary sources. You could almost say she kind of copies straight out for them, actually, sometimes. So she did a lot of research and reading and thinking, and was really trying to kind of, again, pull the sounds and the textures of the Ireland of the day into her novel.
My name is Nancy Harrell, and I'm in Boston, Massachusetts, and I work with the historical harps at the Museum of Fine Arts. And I'm also a professional harpist and have recorded the first CD of harps by the harpmaker John Egan. As a child, Sydney was surrounded by music. Her father was in the theater and he sang professionally, and he even ran a musical theater in Kilkenny. So their family friends were musicians and singers, and she was really born into a musical family. Her grandmother was a harpist. She was so well known in her village, she was given the name Clarshach Navalak, or village harp. And we know, as a young girl, Sydney sang to the harp at musical gatherings. She seems to have had quite a distinctive style of singing, because there's a lovely anecdote from her memoirs of someone recognizing her just by her voice. "He stole into the drawing room, which was full of company, not to interrupt the song which a young girl was singing to the harp. It was the Irish cronan of Ned of the Hill. The air was scarce finished when he sprang forward and seized the harpist in his arms, exclaiming, 'This must be Sidney Owenson. It is her father's voice. None but an Irish voice could have such a curve in it. And she is my godchild.' And he had not seen his godchild since the christening dinner." The Gaelic harp, or clarsach, was played in Ireland for 1,000 years. This is one of the country's oldest and most honored traditions. You know, in ancient times, each clan had its honored harper, and it was the favorite instrument of the kings and the chieftains. Well, as society changed in the 1600s, for a time, traveling harpers continued to find patrons in the big houses. You know, this was a time of Trelawch Carolan. But by the late 1700s, really the society's musical preferences changed in favor of the continental art music. But the chromatic nature of this music was not idiomatic to the wire-strung clarsach. It had a fixed tuning in modes. And so without work, the numbers of harpers dwindled, and eventually the tradition came to an end. The actual harp that replaced the clarsach at this time in Ireland was the French pedal harp, first conceived in Paris. And these were beautiful instruments. They were really pieces of furniture with hand-painted scenes on the soundboards. But the interesting thing is they were strung with gut strings. Gut is a pliable material, and they were fixed with mechanisms in which the harpist could activate by pedals. And so harpists could play passing accidentals in the music, and they could play in lots of different keys. And this was the harp that came into Ireland at this time. It is interesting that in Sidney's novel, The Wild Irish Girl, there are various characters. There's an old bard, but he's not the harpist. In The Wild Irish Girl, the harpist is Glorvina. And this really mirrors what was happening in Ireland at the time. The traveling bard was replaced by the lady of the manor taking up the instrument. And the character Glorvina tells us that her harp is strung with gut instead of wire, merely for the gratification of her own ear. Plangsty Irwin is by Trelawch Carolan. And in the Book of the Boudoir by Lady Morgan, she writes of her success playing Carolan airs on the Irish harp. Egan invented a new Irish harp in the early 19th century that was so important that it really enabled a new harping tradition to flourish and to continue. And his new portable Irish harp was literally copied by subsequent generations of harp makers. And that was the inspiration for today's Irish harp or Celtic harp. These harps were strung with gut strings, and they were given sharping mechanisms so harpists could play in different keys. And the sound box was formed like smaller versions of the French harps with semicircular back, which was quite different from the old clarshuck that had a sound box hollowed out of a single log of wood. These harps were portable. At this time, remember, ladies of distinction made the grand tour of Europe, and they liked to take their instruments with them. So it was a stroke of genius to invent this small harp about 3 feet in height young ladies could travel with on their tours. And they were available in green and blue and black. And to reinforce the Irishness, they were decorated with strands of golden shamrocks. And this model later became known as the Royal Portable Irish Harp. In The Wild Irish Girl, a passage describes Glorvina's playing. Her harp was tuned, and she began another exquisite old Irish air called Dream of the Young Man. And here is that air played on an Egan harp, later known as The Young Man's Dream.
Nancy Harrell playing Glorvina's old Irish air from The Wild Irish Girl on a harp built by John Egan. And Nancy also performs the other harp music on the programme. Returning to Owenson, she styled herself on Glorvina, as Julie Donovan said, and she became the embodiment of the fictional Gaelic princess.
In practically all of Owenson's novels, and even in her poems, she cannot help to put herself in as the heroine. Most of her heroines are a composite, or with Glorvina, perhaps an actual transplant of herself into the novel. So there's this notion of the autobiographical element. But with The Wild Irish Girl, because that novel was so popular, it went into about 7 editions in 2 years, upper-class Anglo-Irish women became quite enamoured of Glorvina as the sort of Celtic princess, the Celtic glamour of Glorvina, and started calling Owenson herself Glorvina. So Owenson sort of thought, oh, well, this could be a good business opportunity possibly, and was humouring these women, and she signed off on her letters as Glorvina when they addressed her as Glorvina, and she entertained them. She was invited to all the classy parties in town, and she played her harp and sang and entertained them, and in some way she was charmingly Irish to order, and they were intoxicated by Owenson there with her harp singing, you know, telling witty stories, and she sort of capitalized on the marketability of being Irish.
Did she also see her harp perhaps as a way of social advancement? Was it a method of getting into, you know, grand drawing rooms that she mightn't have got into otherwise?
I think that it was definitely. There is one letter Owenson wrote to her younger sister Olivia, and she said, practice your music. It is a passe-partout. So it's a French phrase she used, meaning basically your music is going to be a passage to great things. It's going to be a ticket out of obscurity. And I think she saw she had this skill that these rich people did not all have. She had something they did not. They had the money, but she had the cultural capital, if you will, the musical accomplishments. She was very charming, of it very graceful, and she was a great party addition, you know. And yes, she got into those drawing rooms, she got into those parties, partly because of her father's connections with the theatre. He knew the Countess of Moira, for example. Owenson's first published work was a set of poems published in 1801. She dedicated those to the Countess of Moira, who was kind of a bit like an Irish blue stocking, sort of woman of letters, I think strategically. And then she aligned herself with another very powerful and rich woman, Lady Abercorn. Her husband, Lord Abercorn, had great estate in the north of Ireland and also in Britain. And they were very enamoured with her and took her under their wing. Basically, I think enjoyed being her patroness for a while.
The word wild, which appears in the title of her novel, was used at the time to describe the Irish as a barbaric race. But its meaning was subtly transformed.
She kind of uses it ironically in the sense that when Horatio goes to Ireland expecting the wild savages, you know, the barbarians, instead he comes across Glorvina, who is very much wild in the sense that she's a child of nature. She's very natural, while at the same time she's very beautiful. Owenson was inspired by Rousseau, who was very much into, you know, the children of nature, not to be affected, have this simplicity. So he finds the wildness in terms of naturalness rather than any sort of savagery.
People were drawn to the novel because of this idea of the wildness and the unknown of Ireland. But what Sidney cleverly did was to show how cultured Ireland was. And she wrote reams and reams of notes about the fantastic Gaelic harping tradition in Ireland at the time. I'd like to mention her role as a harp scholar in this book, The Wild Irish Girl. She corresponded with the respected antiquarian J.C. Walker for this book. And from this book, we learn all sorts of things, that Gaelic harps were strung with four kinds of wires, their method of tuning, that there were actually 15 lady harpers proficient in harp on the ancient Gaelic harp. There were notes about Turlough Carolan. This is the main source for Dennis Hempson, a very famous harper from the old days. And so harp scholars turn to this book, The Wild Irish Girl, for our heritage and information about the harping tradition in Ireland.
You've already had a kind of recovery of the image of the harp, especially by the United Irishmen. And so that idea, you know, of the United Irishman motto, it is new strong and shall be heard, the harp as a kind of an active symbol of political identity and indeed political resistance, is very much in the air for Owenson. She's also aware of other similar symbols of Irishness, such as shamrock, the very idea of greenness, these kinds of, the idea of the emerald green, you know, Ireland being the Emerald Isle, a gem in the ocean. All of those ideas which were slightly set in float by the volunteers in the 1780s and then really taken on board by the United Irishmen in the 1790s, she almost wholesale transports that whole iconography and imagery into her fiction. But of course, it's a bit like the political agenda itself. So what happens when that imagery goes into the fiction is complex. It's not straightforward. So Glorvina does play the harp, but she doesn't just play it to kind of subdue her English lover. She plays it to kind of inspire him into a kind of version of patriotic feeling for Ireland itself. And then she's also quite capable, particularly in some of the later novels like O'Donnell, of poking fun at the harp. The heroine is in a conversation with this kind of fashionable English lady who expresses a desire to go to Donegal to visit the heroine who is on her way to Donegal. And she says, you know, I imagine this part of Ireland must be wonderful. She says, you know, harps being strong and re-strong and your fabulous mountains and all that greenness. And she says, I mean, that's what I always used to think about Switzerland, this English heroine says, of course, until I went there and then I got bored, you know. So Sidney Owenson is very capable of making us think about how easily vibrant political imagery of resistance can become commercialised and commodified and become too comfortably part of a kind of mass market version of Irishness.
She saw the harp in many ways. Obviously, it was a sign of the bardic tradition of Ireland, which was revered. She supported the United Irishmen and the Irish Volunteers, who used the harp as a form of cultural nationalism. And the United Irishmen organised the Belfast Harpers Festival, and they saw cultural nationalism as very important in terms of political strategy. So she took that, she reappropriated the harp being a symbol perhaps foisted on Ireland and made it sort of Ireland's own. So it was a form of nationalism, but she also used it as a form of female expression as well. Curiously, Ryanair's symbol, which is a harp, if you look at the harp very closely on Ryanair airplanes, it's actually a woman's body in flight. So I'm not sure if Michael O'Leary knew that. But so there was this notion that it was fashioned into a female symbol as an ornament, which Owenson changed by sort of revitalising it in a feminist way. But Owenson also took the notion of the bard, the very old sort of almost decrepit bardic character, which was being destroyed by colonialism, and revitalised that in the form of the sort of female bardic figure, enlivening it and taking the passive symbol of the harp that had been fashioned into a sort of more positive interpretation.
Thank you.
I say one more thing actually about the harp on that theme. The same year that Lady Morgan published O'Donnell, 1814, Jane Austen published her great novel, Mansfield Park, probably Austen's greatest novel. And in that novel, one of the ways we figure out that something's wrong with the character of Mary Crawford, the woman who kind of might be the wife in the novel but turns out not to be a good enough character, is when she insists on having her harp brought down to the country from London. And she explains that she finds it terribly hard to get any farmers or workmen to transport her harp for her. And it's explained to her that, well, actually, they're all at harvest, so, you know, nobody has time to be lugging your harp around. In the Austen novel, she uses this fashionable idea of the harp as an index of the kind of triviality of the character, really. Mm. And she's taking that very much from Lady Morgan. It's coming directly through it. So even though Owenson is always aware of the deep meanings of the harp and its incredible resonance as an image of Ireland, she's also very alert at the same time about the ways in which that image could be trivialised or commodified.
In terms of the harp, which was really the instrument she's most aligned with, she took its very serious aspects, the notion that it was an instrument of cultural gravitas for the Irish, it was a form of cultural, you know, nationalism, took all these different aspects and, you know, synthesised them and had these very serious, had a serious political agenda with the harp, but also saw its more humorous aspect. In terms of women, Jane Austen has a famous passage in one of her novels, Mansfield Park, where Mary Crawford is sort of dying to get her man. So she thinks, oh, I know how I'll ensnare him. I'll play my harp. And Jane Austen writes, you know, any man who looks at a woman playing a harp will be, you know, automatically enticed. And lots of novels of the period have these sort of more devious women playing the harp, and it's this sort of alluring effect. Owenson also takes that, but sort of makes it even more humorous than Jane Austen and sort of parodies it in terms of, you know, the paradox of this female instrument that was very alluring also being something that was capable of parody as well.
Julie Donovan there from George Washington University in Washington, D.C., on the attraction and allure of the harp. Sidney Owenson, Lady Morgan, was not only a novelist and a harp-playing society cult figure, she was also a songwriter and a composer. She published her 12 Hibernian Melodies in 1805, writing new words to old Irish airs and composing piano accompaniments to the songs. These songs are never performed today, so we recorded some specially for the programme. Here's one of them, Leave Me Not Love, sung to an air by Carolyn.
Leave me not love in pity stay, and charm my timid doubts away. Oh, leave me not to woe and pray, return my love, return. In vain the thank you.
Father Robert Owenson had a particular fondness for Carolyn, and Sidney definitely inherited this fondness. And she wrote in 1805, "I was so enthusiastic in my passion for Irish music and had obtained such a pretty little success by playing the airs of Carolyn on my Irish harp that I actually engaged with Messrs. Power and Golding of London to collect and arrange 12 Irish melodies." I think it's interesting that although the volume was inspired by these harp tunes, the publication was actually produced and arranged for the pianoforte. But this is what they did at this time. It just seemed a more commercial and viable proposition, as the pianoforte was really the instrument more widely played.
Didn't compose that much. She did 12 Hibernian melodies, but she took the notion of the female creator of music in a very interesting direction, in the sense that she saw that sometimes the most powerful aspect of music is not just the oral aspect, but it's the visual. Sometimes the most powerful experience of music is when you see it being performed. And the harp, because it's such a beautiful visual instrument, a woman playing the harp was this great moment of synesthesia, when the oral and the visual and the sensory all sort of come together. And I think that's what distinguished her most. And mixing that with her ability as a composer and with the way she composed 12 Hibernian melodies, taking together these different aspects of the harp into this really, really interesting synthesis.
On the Wave from Owenson's 12 Hibernian Melodies, sung by Laura Murphy. And Laura also sang the other songs from the collection. The name of the tune is The Mountain Sprite, and Owenson tells us it came from Carolyn, but that information appears incorrect. All the same, there are some obvious parallels between Thomas Moore and Lady Morgan. Moore's Irish Melodies appeared 3 years after her Hibernian Melodies. So, was he influenced by her songs, I wonder? That very tune, which is not a particularly well-known one, was used by Thomas Moore. Both Moore and Owenson entertained by singing songs in upper-class drawing rooms. Both used Irish melodies in their songs, and both formulated a political agenda in their writings. Moore acknowledged Owenson's patriotic genius in his preface to the first set of the Irish Melodies, or perhaps it came from Moore's publisher. We cannot be sure. I wonder, Julie, do you think there was any rivalry between them?
There might have been, but, Sidney Owenson knew Thomas Moore and she relished their friendship. She would love to have been friends with Byron, who was a great friend of Thomas Moore's, but she never quite got into the sort of boys' club there. I think that Owenson was an accomplished musician and an accomplished singer, and she did write two sets of poems. She wrote Lay of an Irish Harp, and she also wrote poems, but she wasn't a poet, and I don't think she saw herself as a poet. I think the novel really was the form that she was more invested in. So perhaps if there was any rivalry, she left it by thinking, well, Moore's the poet and I'm the novelist.
There are lots of parallels, and I think maybe, I mean, it seems odd to say it now, but maybe even just the simple fact of her being a woman and his being a man means maybe we haven't looked at those parallels enough and thought about them enough. I mean, they both were always hard up. He was always, just dodging the next bill, writing to pay the next set of creditors. In some ways, his circumstances were harder than hers because he had a large family to support and so on. She never had children, and she always managed to have a little bit of money put by, so she was always safe enough. And she left a reasonable amount of money when she died, for example. But Thomas Moore was always working under harder circumstances. Unlike her, he kept the kind of the patronage relationship going more strongly all through his life. And of course, he did benefit more from the kind of clubbable male circles that he was able to move in London. So he had such a good relationship with Lord Byron, for example, and Lord Byron described Lady Morgan as writing feminine trash, you know. So there are kind of similarities, but also disparities. But the most important thing is, you're right, is the fact that they were both so interested in, particularly in song and in poetry, as opening up through the ear a kind of a passage into a sort of a secret history or a truer history of Ireland.
Claire Connolly elaborating on the similarities and disparities between Owenson and Moore. Sidney Owenson appears a larger-than-life character with a canny understanding of how the world worked and, perhaps more importantly, how to draw attention to herself. Claire, you noted how hard it was for her to forge a path.
That's right, and I suppose I've been stressing how important it is that she was a professional who made her living as a writer. But she actually allows us to almost understand a kind of a change in British and Irish literary culture of the period, from a culture of kind of patronage to one of professional literary production. So in her own short lifetime, she did have a patron, Lord and Lady Abercorn, took her to their family estates in the north of Ireland, and they more or less paid her to sort of stay with the family and to produce her next novel after The Wild Irish Girl under their patronage. But she also broke free of that arrangement and made it commercially as a writer. So, and she's always negotiating back and forth about what it means to work and live in the public eye. And I suppose it goes back to that thing about the theatrical background. In some of the early biographies, there's a suggestion that she might have acted herself. And when they say that, you know, in the 19th century, they're really suggesting something quite racy, and that, you know, her reputation mightn't have been any better than it should be, kind of. So she was always surrounded by scandal and accusations and half-truths and gossip all around her. But she was working all the time to try and kind of manage and control her reputation. I mean, maybe if I just tell you a bit more about that, it might be interesting to see, because one of the things she almost cultivated was quite an antagonistic relationship with some of the people who wrote reviews of her books. Now, in the 18th century, people talked about puffing, you know, that you would puff up a book and give it notice and get it into the public eye. And it was very hard to do something like that if you were a young woman in London, recently arrived from Dublin. But she found herself almost straight away at the wrong end of some of the reviewers. You know, she was criticised for not being able to spell, for being too smart for her own good, for not being properly domesticated. She'd be better off staying at home and getting a husband. You know, these kinds of things were said about her. And instead of kind of retiring or, you know, being hurt by these accusations, she just went after the reviewers and she drew them on herself and got into quite public disputes and rows. And she was continuing to do that right up until the very end of her life. So she's someone who was, you know, in adverse circumstances, trying to kind of create something like a kind of a publicity machine around her own writing.
She enjoyed an unusually long and productive life, but what about her later activities?
Well, she was still courting controversy. So one of her last publications follows up a little controversy that arose from her travel book about Italy, where she has some very sceptical things to say about items in the Vatican collection, including St. Peter's chair. And she got into public debate with the Archbishop of Westminster about it, Cardinal Wiseman. And so she's publishing small things like that and getting into public rows.
She was really a self-made woman. She dealt with her publishers in a very savvy way. She played them off against each other, never undersold herself, was very astute, obviously, with her money and her savings. And unlike poor old Thomas More, who died very poor and destitute, she died a wealthy woman. Her last home was 11 William Street in Knightsbridge, which is still there. It's just behind Harrods there. So she very much was this self-made woman, and she was also a feminist who not only advocated feminism, she lived feminism. You know, she was this woman who had her own life, her own money, and forged ahead, you know, on her own.
Well, I think she would have fit in the 21st century quite easily. I've become quite fond of her in my research. I came across a lovely quote by her biographer Fitzpatrick in 1860. He says, "Her wit and vivacity, the nerve with which she swept the strings of her harp, and the exquisite modulations of her voice in accompaniment, charmed widely and bound captive many a heart long wrapped in apathy." She was really fearless and independent. Early on, you know, it was quite a daring thing when she was seeking a London publisher for her second book, and she just found the name of a publisher in a newspaper and wrote to him and crossed the Irish Sea all on her own and then boarded a stagecoach to London and met this publisher, and he was totally charmed by her. You know, this was quite a daring thing for a young woman to do in the early 1800s. And incidentally, with the publication of that book, The Novice of St. Dominic, her first purchase was an Irish harp from Egan and a black mode cloak.
So, like all style icons, she knew where her priorities lay. Harpist Nancy Harrell there, who has formed a special attachment to Lady Morgan and Egan's Irish harps. Sidney Owenson, or Lady Morgan, was a truly amazing woman, a successful writer of novels, poems and travel books, an ardent patriot who used every opportunity to comment on Ireland. A feminist and self-made woman who earned a sizable fortune against the odds, and she fearlessly took on the establishment. But she was also a glamorous hostess and entertainer, a cult figure who invented a pseudo-Irish fashion style much copied by upper-class women. A society harpist who supported and promoted the new royal portable harps of John Egan. And a singer and composer of songs who probably influenced Thomas More in his Irish melodies, something not generally acknowledged. That's enough achievements for several lifetimes. We'll finish with another of her 12 Hibernian melodies,
Say Canst Thou, O Maid, to the tune of the Cúlan, a melody also used by Moore. Perhaps it was written by Thomas Conlon, a famous Sligo harper. Whatever its provenance, musicians like Sidney Owenson played their part in keeping this magnificent melody alive for future generations.
Say Canst Thou, O Maid, one of the Hibernian melodies of Sidney Owenson. The music was specially recorded for that programme, The Wild Irish Girl and Her Harp, and performed there by Laura Murphy and Una Hunt. Harp airs during the programme were played by Nancy Harrell on the historic Royal Portable Harps of John Egan. Contributors to the programme included Claire Connolly, Julie Donovan and Nancy Harrell. The programme was presented and produced by Una Hunt with sound by Ben Rawlins. The Wild Irish Girl and Her Harp is a Heritage Music production for RTE Lyric FM.